my mom's immediate reaction is, oh, I don't remember this. I didn't know this was in here. I don't know.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied.
And now, here are your hosts, Aaron Dicer and Jeremy Scott.
Every secret has a unique weight to it, and you can only carry them for so long.
Hello, everybody. It's episode 84 of Recotopia. This week's big recommend is Derek Delgadio's In and of Itself. I'm Jeremy Scott.
And I'm Dicer.
And we'd like to say a special welcome to our live listeners and viewers in the chat and those who are watching but not chatting. I believe that's called lurking. Before we get to the big recommend this week, we like to do a couple small recommends every week. Aaron, did you arm yourself with any small recommends for this episode?
It's no big deal.
Itty-bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
I do, and you might want to check Hades to see how the temperature's dropping, because I'm about to recommend a horror movie. I saw Talk to Me this last week, and it's been out for a while, and there's been a lot of buzz about this. I have heard people who loved it. I have heard people who hated it. So I wanted to see for myself, and this is a really good movie. Structurally, it reminds me a little bit, especially metaphorically, of movies like It Follows or horror movies where you can really tie them to a metaphor fairly well. This movie, in my mind, ties fairly well to ideas of substance abuse, teenage experimentation with substances, those kind of things. And basically, this embalmed arm slash hand that grants access to the afterlife, in my mind, I think is very clearly, a stand-in for heavier drugs like heroin, maybe cocaine, like those kind of things. And it could even just be, alcohol abuse or whatever. But the metaphor is really strong, so that's going to appeal to me. It's really well shot, and the tension is really well done. It has some typical horror movie trope stuff. There's some jump scares. There's some, stuff you're expecting to see in horror movies, some disturbing visuals, those kind of things. But it has a lot of really interesting things to say, including an ending, which I'm not going to spoil clearly, but including an ending that is, I think, really bold and willing to take its metaphor to its final place. So I really enjoy Talk to Me, and wanted to throw my voice behind it, as much as I usually don't enjoy horror movies. So this was one that
unless
that
they're made by M. Night Shyamalan.
Those aren't horror movies. I don't think. Well, I mean, I'm not trying to be genre police, but
the old people in the cabin was kind of horror.
The old people in the cabin. Yes. Yeah. Visitation.
No, grandparents in underwear. What's it called? That was I think classified as horror. But yeah, his movies are more like thrillery.
True.
All right. Interesting. I have heard of this movie. And I have, the last 5 or 10 years, been growing my appreciation of horror. And so I will add this to the pile. I should put a sound effect in my board for like throwing a movie on
Jeremy's
a pile.
Jeremy's growing pile of things he needs to watch.
Ladies and gentlemen, one of my small recommends this week is a food product. I can't stay away from recommending food and beverage products to you. In New York City, there's a restaurant that's existed since 1896. It's called Rao's, and it's an Italian-American restaurant started by a man named Joshua Anthony Rao. You can't get a reservation here. They don't do that. You can't walk in off the street here. They don't do that. You have to be mega famous or know someone. That's the only way to eat at this restaurant, which, A, is fascinating in and of itself. I would love to see a reality show about working in this exclusive restaurant. It's considered the hardest table to get in New York City. But some years ago, they started selling frozen products in your local supermarket. And we tried some, my wife and I, and there was like a penne with sausage, and it was good. It was above average for, you know, frozen Italian food. Now, I'm a connoisseur of frozen pizza. I think there is definitely a time and place for a frozen pizza in your life. And Rouse is now selling frozen pizzas. I hadn't noticed them until a week ago. I bought one, and damn it, it's one of the finest frozen pizzas I've ever had in my life. The crust was crispy on the outside, but actually like soft on the inside. The flavors were bold and strong, and I'm absolutely going to buy more Rouse frozen pizzas. So there you go. You can't get into this restaurant. I can't get into this restaurant. There's no way I'm ever going to eat this food other than frozen from my grocery store freezer aisle. And this is about as good a frozen pizza as you're going to find. There you go. Stamp of approval.
Yeah, I've been to Rouse a couple times. I turned down my last invite, but
they do have it looks like Wikipedia says they have a Vegas location.
Oh, okay.
Does bocce? It's like a bocce bar. I don't know what kind of food they have there. It looks more like bocce and cocktails, but there is a Rouse in Vegas. I know you sometimes have been to Vegas. You might want to check it out.
No, I've never heard of this. You know, looking at the images of the pizzas, it looks like their crust to, you know, sauce ratio is a little lower than most pizzas. A lot of crust on the edges. I find that to be, especially if the crust is good, to be a good thing.
I agree.
Sometimes I feel like pizzas put the sauce too close to the edges and you don't have a lot of crust to snack on at the end of your piece.
My wife doesn't even eat crust, and it just baffles me.
It's like having a built-in breadstick, man. Like it can be really
good
stuff.
Especially if you get pizza at some of these places, which is most of them now, that'll give you crust flavorings. Like
right.
Jet's Pizza, I don't know if you have that where you're at, but it's Detroit style, but they have six different crust toppings, or you can just get them all. It's like garlic, sesame seeds.
Yep. Was something that the first pizza place I knew that did that is my favorite pizza place of all time, Hungry Howie's. There isn't one here in Missouri, so it's frustrating, but they're all over Michigan and some different places, but Hungry Howie's was the first pizza place. It was like, oh yeah, you got to get like the buttered cheese crust or the garlic pepper crust or you know, whatever. So yeah, I dig a good flavored crust or a good stuffed crust, even. Like, put some mozzarella in there, that's fun too.
Never gonna hurt anybody.
All right, ready for my second recommends?
Okay.
Doing two movies this week because I also got a chance to finally see Theater Camp.
Oh, wow.
This is one of the best movies I've seen this year. Now, a lot of this has to do for my nostalgia for the topic. I was a theater kid. In fifth grade, I tried out for the community production of Huck Finn, landed the role of Huck Finn, and I never looked back. Like, theater was something that was with me, you know, throughout even college. Jeremy, you and I were in a theater production together in college. So I know these human beings, and they are my people. And this movie gets everything so right about the precociousness of what it means to be a theater kid, about the elevated sense of artistry that comes with, you know, being a performer and those kind of things. It also gets the nuance of what makes theater, stage theater, so powerful, so interesting. This movie is hilarious. I laughed a lot, and I actually was bawling at some things that happened at the end. It moved me in some really deep ways. And I was not expecting that. But this has a denouement that I think is among the best I've seen in a while, where it's a callback to something that is hilarious. And at the same time, it just works. And I'm trying not to get detailed, but love the ending of this movie. Loved this entire movie. Huge, huge recommend. I think if you've never done theater, if you've never been involved in drama or whatever, I still think you can have a really good time with this movie. But if you have, I think it'll be euphoric. At least it was for me. So
I was in a play production all 4 years of college, every single year. And I never went to theater camp, but I went to camp. I went to church camp a lot. And I think those two things are probably going to make this right up my alley. Yes. And I love the gal from The Bear whose name I'm intimidated to pronounce. Io.
It's Io. Yeah, it's Io.
So I love her, so I'm excited. I want to see Bottoms that she's also in. That has also gotten good reviews. So yeah, this is.
There are two members of the Bear cast in theater camp.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think what her name is. Molly Gordon, who plays
the love interest from season two.
The love interest, yeah. She's kind of the, her and Ben Platt kind of play the main central characters.
Okay.
And Ben Platt is so great in this.
Ever since that season two of The Bear, I've noticed her everywhere. Like, we went back and did Booksmart. She's in that and just a bunch of places that she's shown up. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Claire Bear. Yeah, Claire Bear chat. Thank you for chiming in there. Appreciate the reference. Nice. My second recommend is a movie because I can't stray too far from the light. and this is a movie I've seen many, many times, but recently watched again last week. It's Dances with Wolves, Kevin Costner's directorial debut. And I will start at the outset and say there's a little bit of problematic nature to the plot of this film in that it is pretty much a white savior coming from the East and saving the Native Americans. So that being acknowledged, there are also some Native Americans that did not, particularly the Pawnee, who are in the movie portrayed as fairly bloodthirsty. And in real life, they felt like it was the Lakota who had savaged them. So this is not a historical document of any kind. It is a fictional story about a broken man who is sent to a barren outpost in the Midwest, basically to die, and ends up befriending a nearby Native American tribe through the course of ups and downs. I don't know how much credit of this movie I'm ready to give Kevin Costner, and I love Kevin Costner. Please don't take that the wrong way. But the cinematographer is doing so much heavy lifting here that, I mean, the movie is just beautiful. Like, seeing it in HD versus the first many times I saw it is jaw-dropping how gorgeous this movie is. And then a lot of the Native actors, like Graham Greene, and then another white actor, Mary McDonnell, I think are doing the acting heavy lifting, although Costner is good in this. There are two parts of this movie that break me. I'm going to go ahead and tell you to Google, does the dog die? Because there's an animal that he befriends that... just Google that. And then at the end, when he has the shouting exchange with the guy that had been sort of antagonistic to him from the beginning and now is his friend, and it just breaks me because they're being separated probably forever, and he's yelling, "You'll always be my friend." I'm getting chills just now thinking about it. Anyway, if you've never seen it, it's on Pluto and Tubi for free right now with ads. It's on the Roku channel for free, and it's on Amazon Prime Video if you have a subscription. And it's just really, really, really good. There you go.
It has been a long time since I've seen this movie. I owe it a revisit, I'm sure. But I, you know, my primary memory of seeing this movie is that my mom rented it on VHS for all of us on vacation. And the scene with Costner's butt came on, and the story around the family is, you know, my mom's immediate reaction is, "Oh, I don't remember this. I didn't know this was in here. I don't know."
I do have a guy in the chat, Josh Zero, saying, "Yeah, but Jeremy, this movie is 7.75 hours long." Yeah, it is long. It is not a short film. It is 3 hours and 1 minute. Exactly. And you'll feel some of that, but I still think you'll appreciate it.
I lament the days of the 90 to 105 minute movie being kind of the standard. Everything seems to want to hit 2 hours now. But I got to say, length doesn't bother me if it's a good movie. Like, if it's something I'm enjoying, like, especially if I'm watching at home, I can pause and go to the bathroom if I need to. But yeah, I don't mind movies being longer.
I mean, I don't either. We had this chat on Slack recently, the group of us. Just give me an intermission. Like, if you're going to hit 2:45 or up, just give me a 5-10 minute bathroom break.
Yep.
I can't sit in one place for 3 hours. I mean, it's just human nature. The more I age, it's only going to get worse. I'll be asking for two intermissions. But it is frightening to me how many three-hour movies we've gotten in the last 2 or 3 years, and we're going to continue to get. Scorsese's next movie is going to be over 3 hours, but apparently
3.5. That's like justified. His new standard. His last two movies are just
and
3.5 hour movies.
It's where we're at. Just give me an intermission, or you know, the thing I love about streaming, or at least waiting for most movies to be purchasable at home, is that I can hit the pause button. I'm in control of my own intermission, and your 3 hour movie will not intimidate me.
That is true. That is true.
All right. We're ready for this week's a big recommend.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Am I saying his last name right? Derek Delgadio?
Yeah, I think itself? That's correct.
All right. Yeah. Aaron, take us away.
Derek Delgadio's In and of Itself is a movie. It is a movie of a stage show. It is directed by Frank Oz. This was a stage show done by Derek Delgadio in New York City for, I believe the text said, 552 performances.
Yeah, that's wild.
Of this show in New York City. And this is a hard one to kind of do a plot take. So I'm just going to kind of give the structural foundation of the movie, and then I think we can have a discussion on whatever parts we want to talk about. But basically, we are introduced through narration to Derek Delgadio, who is talking about identity. What, you know, how do you define yourself? What does it mean to be you? And this entire show will deal with that theme in many and various ways about how are you defined? Who gets to define you? What do they know? All of those kind of things. We are introduced to a story about a rouletista. This is a story he's told by somebody at a bar about a person who just survives the game of Russian roulette so many times that they get the nickname the rouletista, and eventually adds more and more bullets to gun, always survives, and then eventually decides to retire and has a home invasion and is shot dead by somebody who is invading the home. The irony there of, you know, surviving all the Russian roulette, but somebody who doesn't know who they are, again, going back to identity, being the one that pulls the trigger that actually does them in. This person tells Derek that he is the rouletista, and then we get to see Derek wrestle with this through six vignettes. Well, technically five plus the rouletista. And those are represented gun chamber style on the back wall with six different squares, and he goes through them. One deals with the bottle. That's the first one. He does a magic trick involving putting this ship that he folded, this piece of paper, into this bottle of alcohol. He does that trick. The second one deals with the ship's log, this idea that, you know, mariners had to write down for other people what they saw, or they wouldn't be able to get where they were going. And with this in mind, he picks somebody from the audience who he's going to call Mr. or Mrs. Tomorrow, and at some point in the show is going to send them home before it's over so that they can come back the next day and read their version of how they think it was going to end. And also introduces us to Mr. or Mrs. Yesterday, who is at the show, you know, today, that will be doing that. So that's the ship's log, and we see a little bit more of the ship, of this, you know, page and how that's working. Then we go to the time between dog and wolf is the next section. This is a story of how when the sun goes down, if you're looking into the sun, you can't really tell what's between you and the sun. And so it could be a dog, it could be a wolf, it could be, you know, a predator to kill you, it could be a friend who is going to support you, but you just can't tell during the time between dog and wolf. And then that section ends with one of my favorite lines of the show, which there are so many deep quotes of this show that I've taken with me, but I love this one because of how deep it feels to me. If you're willing to turn your back on the sun, everything else is illuminated, which is a really interesting way to view the idea of when you're dealing with, oh, is that a dog or a wolf? If you turn, you become, am I the dog or the wolf? And you see everything clearly. And that's kind of where he goes with.
But now the wolf is behind you.
Yes, yes, exactly. That leads into a story called that I'm calling The Brick. By the way, he doesn't name these. I'm naming these for my own, you know, understanding. But this deals with a brick that is in a glass wall. He tells a story about secrets, and the secret in his case was that his mom was gay. He found that out at a young age and found out very quickly that for other people that would ostracize him, that they would not play with him, not be his friend, not if they knew, so he held on to this secret. He tells the story of people in the city finding out and throwing a brick through their window as he has a brick through a window behind him. It's a really interesting thing. Then he pulls the brick and he says, this is just a brick. We painted it gold. We brought it here, but it's so much more to you because you know the story, right? He says, I think I can help you to see this as just a brick. Does another magic trick involving building a house of cards around this brick. Brick disappears. It will apparently appear on a street corner in New York City, and the people just walking by won't see anything meaningful in that brick. It'll just be a brick by a light post. And so that's that story. We then go into the story of the blind men and the elephant, which is a very famous story. Most people have probably already heard this story, the idea of the six blind men who encounter different parts of the elephant and have very different ideas about what it is. He spins this story on its head by saying, have you ever thought about how the elephant feels about this? How does the elephant feel about being defined by other people trying to figure them out? And so at that point, after that story, is when Mr. or Mrs. Tomorrow leaves. They're left to try to figure out what happens for the rest of the show. Another one of my favorite lines is said, everything in this book is accurate to everything that happened here, even though it contains things both real and imagined. So the accuracy is not dependent on whether things are real or false, which is another theme he's presented throughout this idea, even in his narration to us. The final act is, I'm calling the scale. He places all of these I am cards, which I haven't really mentioned in the plot rundown yet, but there's a whole wall of these cards that say, I am such and such. I am a such and such. I am a philosopher. I am a teacher. I am a mother. I am, and each of the audience members is asked to select one of those cards before they go in. And he has the entire stack of those cards, places them on the scale, and then just has the part that says, I am, places it on the other side, and somehow it balances all of that out. He then goes into the audience and asks them, who of you chose definitions for yourself that are meaningful to you? Some of you probably did jokes. I understand that. That's great. But who, you know, stand up if you did something that's meaningful to you. People in the crowd stand, and one by one, through some sort of memory, he identifies who they are and what cards that they chose. You can see the meaning on this in their eyes as he reflects back to them their own self-perception in that way. The show ends with the declaration that he is the Ruletista after he names everybody else, and because that's how the guy saw him, and then that's how he started to see himself. And as he pulls the final trigger on the loaded gun, it clicks again. But all of the images of who he is that have been in the background as three-dimensional actual windows into all these objects fall off the wall as pieces of paper, and there is just one window left. Somehow that has changed. There's one element of the show I have not mentioned yet as I went through them. And I don't know if that's because I forgot to label them. Oh, I know what it is. It's in The Blind Man and the Elephant. Probably the most powerful part of the show for me is he does a trick, because this is a magic show in many ways, involving a person reading a letter from somebody important through their life. And I have never wept so much just watching someone read a letter. They're not even, I mean, they do eventually read them out loud, but for the first part, you're just watching them absorb how somebody important to them defines them, sees them, gives them value, knows them well. And that, he is saying, is more important than the blind men trying to figure out what the elephant is somebody who actually knows you, loves you, cares about you, how they define you and how they see you. So there you go. That is Derek Delgadio's In and of Itself, as best as I can sum it up in the different sections. I'm going to hand it over to you, Jeremy. I have never been more unaware of how you might feel about something. You, like, there is a very real possibility that you may hate this, you may love this, you may fall somewhere in between, but I have never been more excited to have a conversation with you. How did you feel about Derek Delgadio's In and of Itself?
This thing had me for the first two-thirds. I love the mix of comedy, magic, dramatic beats, the imagery of the cubbies on the wall, the chambers, if you will, and the telling of his personal stories, specifically the brick section. There's a line in there where he's talking about, before his friend can come in, I have to go in and scurry around and hide evidence of who I wasn't, and then say, hiding all the evidence of my mother's pride. And that socked me in the gut.
Yeah.
It really, really did. When we get to the letters and then the naming everybody's card, he loses me, man. I get why the people there are experiencing what they are. And I think you are better able to connect to, if I were there, this is how I would feel. Whereas there's so much magic in this show. And it's so impressive. The sleight of hand is wild. That scene where he's telling the story about the four kings, and then, oh, look, they're not in order, and he puts them in order, and then you realize he's actually put all the other ones in order, too, just by shuffling while
before
you
watch him. Before he turns him over, he says, I've still got a little wolf in me or whatever. Yeah.
And then the brick thing, I'm pretty sure that's the trick. There's a trick in this show that Penn Jillette said completely fooled him, and I'm pretty sure it's that gold brick trick where he builds the cards up around them. I have some ideas on how it might have been done, but it was jaw-dropping. When he gets to the letters, it felt manipulative to me. Because, first of all, I'm pretty sure he calls out a card thing, like who said that they are a teacher tonight or what have you.
Right.
And it's that person who comes down and he's like, oh, I have a letter for you. So, I mean, first of all, there's no magic here for me. It's clear and obvious what he's done. He's taken somebody he knows has bought a ticket. He's gone to their loved ones. He's asked them to write a letter, but he's probably also asked them to write a really flowery, nice letter.
Well,
nobody's going to stand on that stage and read a letter that said, I hate you. Why am I writing this letter?
No, he's probably prompted them with, he's probably even gone further than that. He's probably prompted them with, make this letter about how you see them, you know, how you envision them, who they are, you know, like he, you know, to fit the identity theme.
So that to me feels, how do I say this? The first two thirds of the show feel like something only he could ever have done. It could only have come from his mind. When it gets to the letters, I feel like anybody could have come up with, we're going to pull a person on stage and have them read a letter from their mom that talks about how nice they are, and then they're going to cry, and then we got them. So that is where I started to detach a bit. And then when he's walking up the stairs telling everybody what their thing is, it felt like crossing over to me, and not like, it felt
crossing from what to what?
No, the show crossing over where the guy talks to your dead relatives in heaven and is just playing mind trick because he's a mentalist. And I am not convinced it was memory, although memory is certainly one of the ways you could do that.
Yeah, I shouldn't have thrown that. I don't have any backing on.
I think it could be memory. But I also think it could be as simple as a tiny hidden earpiece, because there's video taken of all those people choosing their cards.
Yeah.
And so I was much less impressed with the magic of those moments that there at the end between the letters and the naming. So it became hard for me to react emotionally to it or live in that moment, which is not to say that I think it's bad. I thought it was holding more power. Listen, I get why he does this, but I was much more into it when it was about him and he was telling me his stories. I get that the whole thing is about identity and he has to flip it around on the audience. And even the showing me of a two dozen different people who were the tomorrow people reading their letters or reading mm-hmm. the book or what have you, showing me all these different identities, which is important thematically, actually was rough for me in terms of suspending any disbelief, because it was just reminding me that this has been done 500 times over and over and over again. And so it became a less of a personal experience for me in that moment. I have lots of notes and I have lots we can discuss. I think the dude is brilliant and I think the show is brilliant. I couldn't attach emotionally.
I think I get it. And I will say this is the primary reason I almost never mention it being a magic show until the end. It's like the last thing I say. Like I would call it a stage show. I'd call it a one man show. I'd call it a movie. Whatever. The magic is just kind of his art. It's how he's been trained or whatever. I don't know that, you know, when you start to speak of it in terms of, I knew how this was done, so it was manipulation, or I knew how, you know, these things anybody could have done or whatever. I think you start to get into the point of the show, which is that he's presenting himself as the Rulatista going, you can walk away from this going, oh, I know how that was done. Oh, I know that was fake. Oh, you're not as good as you think you are, you know. And he has to stand in a darkened theater and let people define him every night. You know what I mean? Like there's this idea of in the defining, in what we're doing, whether we like it or don't like it, we are proving his point, right? We are saying this is, you know, this is how we define you, how we define what you did, you know, all those kind of things. And for me, it becomes more personal the more it gets away from a magic trick. It becomes more interesting to me, more thoughtful
Certainly.
To me.
Telling the story about his mom with the brick mm-hmm. was as engrossed as I've been in anything I've watched in months. I mean, he doesn't even need to do the trick at the end where he makes the brick disappear, though thematically, I think it's very important mm-hmm. to show us. But yeah, that's not a magic trick. That's just him telling a story about his life. And that was the most powerful moment of the whole thing for me.
Yeah. Well, so, let me talk a little bit about the letters and why it's the most powerful moment for me.
Sure,
because I think the prestige there, the reveal there is, you know, this idea that the person who is experiencing this, the setup is what nails it for me, where he's like, he says, there are two things that are about to happen. One only you're going to see, and one we're going to see. And this is, I think, what he's getting at with the metaphorical part, or the thematic part, I should say, of this thing is the letter is going to transform into something from somebody you love. You're going to see that. What we're going to see is you transform based on what you're reading. And the whole point is that when you see somebody through the light of the people that love them the most, they become something different. They don't become just the parts that we see. They become the whole of the people who are intimately involved with them. And that, I don't know, there's something really meaningful about that, because we all struggle with being defined by, especially if you're at all in the public, at all. Like there's this idea of like, oh, I guess I am who you think I am. And then just to be able to, you know, to look and go, why do I check comments? Why do I check social media? Why don't I just look to my wife or my children and say, you know, this is how I see you, and them say, this is how I see you. Like, that's the important stuff, right? So that section of identity there is so meaningful to me, to watch these people on stage transform from how they see themselves to how somebody else who loves them sees them. I don't know. I just found it really, really powerful.
No, I mean, listen, we're just a couple feet apart. That just so happens that mm-hmm. the line is right between us. I could tell you we were getting a little emotional there. And
sure,
I love
sure.
that movies can do this to us. Mm-hmm. And I think we both allow movies to do this to us. And there was certainly a lot of this that reminded me of Roma in terms of the themes, in terms of what you're talking about. And we don't see other people. We see them through our own journey's lens. We don't see them through a lens of somebody who loves them or even their own journey's lens. We don't know what that person is going through. And I get it. I get it. You know, and had I not felt like, had I not felt the way I did going into that segment, I might have been able to, like, I'm trying to phrase this very carefully in saying that I was not able to attach to it emotionally, because I do think that is an incredibly powerful moment for 90% of the people who watch this. And if you were in the theater, or especially if you were one of the people on stage reading the letter, this is probably a top 10 moment of your entire life. I absolutely get it. But I wonder if the magic ultimately doesn't hurt the message for me.
I just saw somebody in the comments, I won't call by name, but says if it's based on a trick, then it's still false and therefore bad. There is no trick here. We all know how this is done. And it's not false. There's nothing false here. It's real. Those words are real, and that emotion is real. Like,
that does not mean it was not manipulated.
Aren't all stories quote unquote manipulative when you tell them? I don't understand how, like, manipulation of course has a bad connotation to it, but we all manipulate the things around us, the stories around us, the things we say. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if
no, it, I'm
like
talking
any
about-
emotion you've ever felt watching a movie,
I'm talking
you
about
were being manipulated.
Where I'm saying anybody could have said, we're going to bring this lady up on stage and she's going to read a letter from her dad who ultimately is going to have Alzheimer's and it's going to bring down the house. That is what I'm talking about. And
you think that's a bad thing for that story to be told, for that experience to be had, because it was...
They don't have a choice. They're called down on stage. They don't even know what's happening. They don't get to actively participate in this moment. They are put on the spot. That's what bugs me about it. That's what feels manipulative about it. If he had said, okay, Anger, come on down. I talked to you before the show. Here's that letter I mentioned. I don't know if I have as much of a problem with it. But they have no agency in this decision. And when you're on the stage and there's 300 people staring at you and it's pin drop silent, what else are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to read the letter and it's going to make you cry. And so now you are an instrument being played and not an active participant in the thing.
I think it's much muddier than that. I think it's much more nuanced than that. I don't think there is the ability to... I think what's happening here, and I think you've even mentioned it, is we have this predisposition against the, let's just say, the televangelist idea, right? Like the idea that he's got an earpiece, he's going to call out, like God's telling them, he knows what's wrong with them, and then he's going to say things about them, or the psychic or the televangelist or whoever who's cheating or whatever. This is a situation where he has said from the very beginning, am I a dog or am I a wolf? Like, what's real, what's not, doesn't matter. In fact, this whole conversation we're having goes back to that thing with the book, right? Where it's like, part of this is fake, part of this is real, but ultimately, does it matter? Like, the experience you're having, the thoughts you're having, I get the agency part. And I think there's validity in what you're saying about the agency. And I don't know what happens if somebody comes up, reads the letter. It appears as if he gives them the choice if they want to share anything out loud or not. And I don't know if there were nights where somebody was like, I will just take this, you know, with me, that kind of thing. And at a magic show, the volunteer thing, how does the agency work? So, I don't know. There is kind of a contract when you walk into a room like that, knowing that there's a show that you're part of it.
There's no contract that you're going to end up on stage reading a letter from your Alzheimer's dad. I was much more upset about this movie after watching it last night than I am now. I'm able to appreciate what it is to you and to other people, even though
Well, there was even one point where he called somebody out and they didn't answer. And like, that's always an option too. Like, you know, there's, I don't know. I don't see anybody forcing anybody to do anything.
The card they chose was like hyper negative. It was, nobody wanted to admit to that.
Oh,
publicly.
It was the idiot. Yeah. Pick the idiot card or whatever. Yeah.
And then he goes, that tracks, which is kind of, anyway, let me talk about some of the things that I really, really enjoyed. The sleight of hand stuff, whether or not you believe it improves the stories is pretty dope. Because I thought he was done doing tricks. Mm-hmm. And was just telling a story and mindlessly shuffling the cards while he did it. I even said to myself, I wonder if that's like a tick, where if he's got cards in his hands because he's done all this practice, he just can't help but shuffle. But no, dude was putting every card in its place without being able to look at them. Like, that trick alone is worth the price of admission for me. Then you add the gold brick trick, and I'm sold on the magic aspect of this show. I love watching the big book because there are scenes where it, like, by the end of his run, that thing is bedazzled by like sequins, all like blue and purple sequins all on the outside. But then
there's one guy that just that did post-it notes on everybody else's stuff.
Yes. This guy just ripped on everybody else's thing. Yeah, I wrote the brick disappearance. How the fuck did he do that? It has to be a collapsible brick with a very thin trapdoor chamber thing under the table. And then I'm not super impressed by the brick ending up on the street corner that the two people named the intersection, because the PA is just running out to do that. I'm not sure about the visuals that are added for this movie version. Like, the when he's talking about the card game, there's some black and white visuals of demon looking eyes. And I don't know that that actually is helping the film. I don't think it hurts, but it felt distracting to me. It made more sense with the elephant story because it felt like we needed a visual there. But again, that's just like the narration stuff. I don't think that's in the stage show. That was just for our benefit as a film viewer. But I wasn't bothered by that. I loved love him taking the I am card, putting it on the opposite scale where there's dozens stacked up, and it levels the scale. That was a beautiful piece of imagery. Pretty mind-boggled about how he did the thing where all of the chambers turn into posters, and it could be as simple as misdirection. Like, he's got,
I think it's probably misdirection. Yeah,
these letter readings over on the far side of the stage, or we're all paying attention to him, well, seven rows up while he's naming.
It's probably all happening while he's going through the crowd, you know, saying, "You are, you know, the poet. You are the, you know, whatever." Like, that's probably because at that point, when he gets, you know, a few rows back, everybody's, you know, turned and watching him at the back. Yeah. So there's probably some misdirection there. Again, the magic part of it has never been the point for me. So, like, all that stuff just seems like, my favorite thing about the card manipulation is that most times you see close-up card manipulation, it's just real. They've just really trained to do that stuff. Like, where he pulls 17 cards off, he just knows what 17 cards feels like.
Yeah, he goes, that's 16. Like, he just knew.
Yeah.
Because the weight. I have no doubt that he just knew. That was some of the most fascinating stuff to me, because in order to be that good, you have to do what he did. You have to practice constantly.
Right.
I also wanted to mention the imagery you mentioned, where he talks about turning your back to the sun and everything becomes illuminated. You know who knows that? Golfers. You go out on the golf course and you're looking for your ball in the rough. You will always turn your back to the sun and look at where you think the ball is, because otherwise you can't see it. But I thought that was a very poetic moment in the show. I think that's all my notes.
Well, I have lots of stuff I could talk about. I will say a few things that are more general. One, I love his style. I think there's something about the way that he communicates that is really compelling. He has a, it's not your typical get on stage, wave your arms around, you know, be the center of attention. He will hold very distinct pauses in a way that I don't see a lot of performers master.
That's because he knows he's got them. He's got right. that entire audience right yes. in that moment. Yes. I love those cuts to the audience where you can see they know they don't know how to react, but they know they should stay quiet right now.
It's yeah. all- yeah, he's so measured, and you get a sense that everything is written perfectly, you know, for him to be able to, you know, transition and, you know, own the audience, all that kind of stuff. The one note I had about the letter thing is I really hope a PA or somebody after the show gives them the rest of the letters. Like, I can't shake it from my mind that they have letters from all these different people in their life. And I just, I hope somebody's like, here are the rest of the letters, read them on your own time, you know, and, or whatever. Cause that would be sad to me if all those wonderful letters,
don't you think there was just one letter per
nope.
show?
No, I think he literally had, that was a free choice. That was a free choice of letter. Like, you'll watch him hand him the whole stack. They will pick the one they want. There's no force going on there or anything. I literally think he had a dozen people in their life that fit the different categories, write them a letter. And so, I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Look, I could be wrong, but I just, I mean, I hope they get the rest of the letters.
I feel like his mentalism and magic skills are good enough that he could get you to take the letter he wants you to take. It's like, I've seen people do that magic tricks all the time.
Sure, sure. But there's always a force, like you can always feel, you can always see the force. He literally hands them a stack of letters. They go through them, keep the one they want, and hand the rest back. There is no force.
He knows which one they're going to choose. I choose to believe.
I think that's that's true magic. If that's the case, if you watch this again, that's insane psychic stuff.
How about
if
this?
He manages to do
the
that.
Same letter is in every single envelope.
No, because it's written on the letter. Father, mother, friend, you know,
all right,
wife, husband. Yeah, they're like, they have, it's like written on the back of the envelope.
All right,
who they are. So
you're
I'm
right
almost
then.
Sure
that's
he
a
had
lot
several
of unused letters, and people, like, if I was somebody who had written a letter for somebody and it didn't get used, I'd be pissed.
That's like, what I'm saying. That's awesome. What my note was. That's what my note was. I hope they get the rest of the letters. But again, that was me assuming I knew how the quote unquote trick was done. But yeah,
you may be right. You're probably right. But I've seen far too much magic.
I understand. I'm just telling you that watch it. Like, when you watch it with this in mind, there is
I'm
no way to force
back
that choice.
To this movie anytime soon.
It's so funny. This is my sixth time watching this movie. I cry at 2 points every single time. It's very meaningful to me.
I would never want to take away from that.
No, of course not. Some interesting trivia stuff we do see, and not a big deal is made of it. It's a bit bigger deal is made for some other than others, but we see like Bill Gates, who chose I Am a Leader. We see David Blaine at one point. He calls him my brother before he sits down. Larry Wilmore, we see Tim Gunn. Calls him a good Samaritan, and Tim starts crying. I also noticed Susan Sarandon and Kate McKinnon in the audience during a couple of these. So it's interesting to kind of look around and see some of the people you know from other stuff just go into this, you know, show and having a good time. In the credits, it says no elephants, dogs, or wolves were harmed during the making of this film. I thought that was funny. And then it said special thanks to the authors of the Book of Tomorrow's Yesterday, which I thought was a really fun way to say that. The woman he whispers to in that scene of like telling people who they are is apparently a legendary performance artist. I didn't know that by watching. I read that afterwards. Marina Abramovic, I believe is her name. And so he whispered to her. One of my favorite quotes in this kind of applies to the long conversation we had. So I'll bring it back here and maybe we can kind of finish up here. But when he's telling the story of the Ruletista, he says he drops several things in that beginning story. And again, this is because I've watched it multiple times that I think apply to everything we see and also even the discussion we just had. And one of those things is he gets to like the adding the third bullet, adding the fourth bullet, and he throws away this line and says, at this point, nobody even cared if he was cheating. And it is that where I find myself in the division between us probably is you care if he was cheating and I don't. I don't care if he was cheating because I think the reality of the emotion is real and the manipulation part of it is a trick. I think that's really interesting how self-aware this show seems at ways. There's also times where he says, you know, you at the end will decide if it matters what is real and what is not. But because you will be doubting everything I do, that makes the reality more powerful or something along those lines. And the way that the movie plays with its own veracity is really interesting to me as well, which again separates it for me from a huckster or a sham artist or somebody like that who's really trying to pretend that this is all real. In that way. So, yeah.
Good stuff.
That's where I think I can end it.
I think so. This is the single most challenging super secret double feature of all time.
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Only two options. I go with another film stage show, which many people have suggested Bo Burnham, or I go back to movies and I try and stay thematically in the world of identity and how we see ourselves and how other people see us. A lot of great suggestions I've seen in the chat, including, let me get back up. There's a lot of chatter today and I appreciate that. But I saw some earlier. I know I saw The Prestige was recommended. Nightmare Alley is a good one. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels would be a fun one. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to tell you that I went with The Talent of Mr. Ripley. A movie where Matt Damon's character does a lot with his identity and who he sees himself as and who the world sees him as. And it completely changes constantly throughout the movie. And I think thematically would be the opposite choice from what Derek makes at the end of his show, to choose to ignore those chambers, those things that have defined him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Damon's character embraces the darker edge of how to interpret that. So there you go. It's no big secret how much I love The Talent of Mr. Ripley. Any excuse to watch it would work. It's eventually going to be a big recommend on this show. So there you go. That's my super secret double feature.
Great choice. Great choice. Love it.
And it falls to me to pick something for next week's homework. I really wanted to give you a curveball by picking some kind of like music concert film or something.
Just, I'd have loved it.
Since you took us to this weird place, but instead I'm going right back to movies with the inspiration for this pick is that I simply think most of you haven't seen this film. It's a 2006 film called The Hoax that stars Richard Gere and Alfred Molina. It is free on Pluto TV. That would be with ads, but that is, I think, fair. Everybody will have a chance to watch this film. And it is about a guy, an author, whose first book underperformed. And I follow almost 40 people on Letterboxd, and nobody has seen or rated The Hoax. There you go. it's about an author whose second pitched book eventually is discarded by the publisher. We are not going to publish it. He goes on a trip to a resort with his friend. And then at 2 in the morning, they're kicked out of the... This is in the 70s, by the way. At 2 in the morning, they're kicked out of the resort because Howard Hughes has arrived, and he wants the entire resort for himself. Howard Hughes is notably eccentric, germaphobe, and public shy, if you will. And through the course of events that happen, he decides to write a biography of Howard Hughes without ever having met or talked to the man at all. And the movie is basically about how he tries to pull that off. It's fairly fascinating. There's one scene that I think is incredible. Nobody I know has really ever seen this. It's an 86, 87 on Rotten Tomatoes. So hopefully you will enjoy it. It is billed as a comedy drama. So hopefully it's not too heavy. And I'm looking forward to seeing it again. I haven't seen it in about 4 years. I hope you guys like it. Aaron, have you seen this film?
I have not seen this. No. Yeah. Nope.
So we're taking turns now, you and I. This will be the third in a row of a recommended movie that the other one has not ever seen.
It's true.
And that's super fun for me because, I think both of us had higher hopes on the last two for the other one's recommendation. But we're going to get to one where it's recommended and the other one hasn't seen it, and we both rave.
My hopes are always for an honest conversation in interesting dialogue, and I think we achieved that today. I think that was certainly achieved today. You see a wolf, I see a dog. You know, it happens. So
Slab says we better hear the story of your falconry weekend and the outtakes. I'm sorry, that didn't happen. We ended up talking about baseball. I'll try and remember for next week to tell Aaron about my falconry experience so that he can end up on the show. That's going to do it for episode 84. Next week's homework is The Hoax from 2006, starring Richard Gere. For Aaron Dicer, this is Jeremy Scott. Thanks to the chat, as always. We'll see you next time.
See you guys.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/CinemaSins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/CinemaSins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@CinemaSins.com. That's recotopia@CinemaSins.com.
What up? What up,
dog? What up, dog? What up, wolf? I'm glad your team is fun to watch.
Oh, my goodness. And they're all, like, just having a blast. And they were down by a run with two outs in the ninth inning. They were down by a run with two outs in the 10th inning. But they won in the 11th inning. And then last night, they were down the entire game to Houston. And Houston won the World Series last year. And they're playing in Houston. And in the ninth inning, we got a three-run homer, take the lead, and win the game. My wife hadn't been asleep, I would have been screaming.
I have woken my wife with sports screaming before.
Yeah, sports screaming. I love that. Just gave a name.
So the most latest time I can remember was U of M basketball in March Madness. Jordan Poole, who now plays for the Golden State Warriors, was, I think, a freshman or maybe a sophomore at the time. Really, you know, young kid or whatever. And he hit a buzzer beater to send them to either the Final Four or the championship game. I can't remember which it was. So this would have been, I don't know, probably like 18, 19, somewhere in that range when this happened. And it was just like there was no, I did not control the thing, the noises I was making. They were just, you know, when you're so invested in something that they just happen. And it was so fun because everybody should watch a clip of this shot, because not only is it a really fun buzzer beater, but the way he celebrates, like his entire team, of course, just like launches off the bench to like, you know, embrace him. You know how you see him tackle him to the floor and embrace him or whatever. And he just runs away from them, like the entire length of the court and all the way around back. He's like, you know, it's just so
like playing chase.
Yeah, yeah. It was like they were playing chase or whatever. When I died the first time and I was in the hospital, it was actually March Madness championship weekend, and they were in the championship game. And one of my first vague memories after coming out of the induced cold coma was watching the championship game with my dad and my brother. So
why did you do that?
Do what?
So I feel like you have like this heart thing that puts you in the hospital,
uh-huh,
and they induce a coma. I feel like there's a physician's responsibility to say you are not allowed to watch your favorite sports team in the championship game right now. We can send a rocket into space and land it back on Earth with precision, uh-huh, but we still don't know what's wrong with that.
There's so much stuff we still don't understand. The blood-brain barrier, like all these things. I just read an article the other day that they think they have found a way to keep the body from attacking itself. So like autoimmune diseases like type 1 diabetes and, you know, some other, that one's close to me because I have a son who is diabetic, that they think they have found a way to cure those autoimmune diseases by selectively telling the body what to ignore as far as like the immune system. Because all those diseases are is the immune system mistaking our own body for a predator.
An attack of some kind, yeah.
So, yeah. That's wild. It is. It's crazy. I just hope we can maintain a culture of the importance of those studies and that work, and that the slight bit of anti-educational bias that I see entering into culture won't keep us from continuing to really study and figure some stuff out.
So you're going to be an optimist on that then?
You know, why not? Why wouldn't I be? I said hope.
I mean,
I hope. I don't, that doesn't mean it will be that way, but I hope.
There's a glass and there's water in it. It's either half full or it's half empty. It's either going in one direction or the other.
It's both. It's both.
I tend to think it's half empty because if you just let it sit there and leave it alone, the water level's going to go down. There's going to be evaporation.
We're sitting there chatting, you know, bedtime, 9:30 or so, and I went, oh, I haven't done my note watch of the movie for tomorrow. And so I was like, oh, no. And so, like, I'm immediately in that, like, panic mode of, okay, what's my morning look like tomorrow morning? Do I have time to watch before the show? When do I have to get out for my morning run to be back in time to get a shower and then also watch this movie, take notes, and, you know, be ready for the show? So this morning has just been just kind of like in you know, when you're trying to focus watch something, like, and you only have a limited time, you know, right, the universe, God, whatever you want to say, is going to present you with obstacles. Like, it just, there's always going to be those things that pop up. And so, like, both of my sons at one point wanted to have conversations. You know, they're waking up and getting around or whatever. And I'm just like, I really love you. And generally, I would pause a movie to have this conversation with you. But I have to get through this in the next hour or whatever.